Welcome back to the Tasting Room, episode 3.
Why are you laughing at me already?
We just started. What was so funny about that?
I don't know. You just smirked at me, I guess.
Yeah, gosh, yeah. I take a breath and then I pause and then we go. Episode 3 so far, I mean, it's not a long track record, but has been my favorite episode so far. Trevor Tack, executive chef. What was the name of the group they just started? Do you remember?
Watershed.
Watershed. There it is.
Yeah, I'm surprised I remembered that.
No, good job.
Thanks.
Hemingway is going to be the restaurant. 1515 15th Street is the address.
Yes.
I remember that because it's really hard to forget.
It is really hard to forget. So Watershed is the group that runs Kilkenny's, NOLA's, now the Hemingway.
Yep.
And they have a few different more projects that are going to be underway. I just feel very lucky to be involved with that group because
yeah.
they are running at a really cool, fast speed.
Mm-hmm.
And Brett and all of those guys down there in that group have big dreams and big minds of creating a lot of different projects.
That they do, yeah. And hang around towards the end because you'll hear more about their involvement, Cabin Boy's involvement with that Watershed group. You want to just get into it?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Put on your tux. It's going to get fancy.
Or not.
Or not. Maybe a tux t-shirt. Who knows? Trevor Tack on the other side after the break.
Thank you. Well, welcome back to the Tasting Room. And today, we have a really cool special
fancy.
Guest. Yeah, we got real fancy, guys. So today, we'll be talking with Trevor Tack.
Hey, how's it going?
Welcome in here, man. You've... I think over how did yourself?
Well, you know, I if you're gonna do something,
yeah. But, I mean, I don't really know where to start with all of this. Let's go with what did you bring?
Okay, so
let's do that.
So the restaurant, the Hemingway that we're building, is it's gonna be an over the top experience. A lot of the stuff that we have, you know, you've seen before. It hasn't been undone. We're not, you know, reinventing a whole lot of wheels on this regard, but we are making some really good wheels down there. So one of the things that I wanted to bring was just some of the things that are kind of going to be indicative to our menu, like our seafood that is going to be prevalent on the menu with the towers and lots of other applications, like a king crab and some Gulf shrimp, little neck clams. And then the other thing that I brought, I had, when John called me, I was in the process of aging Snake River Farms prime ribeye. Has about 55 days on it of age. And I've got some other plans for the rest of it, but I did bring some tasting in here. And I brought two of my favorite wines because I heard this was a tasting show, and I heard
it
that
is.
He was bringing whiskey and you were bringing beer, and I'll be dinged if I show up empty-handed.
Right on.
Speak of the devil.
Salute.
There is ice over here if we need it. So this, again, is from the bourbon group Spirits of Legend. This was a barrel pick from New Riff in Kentucky. Kentucky straight bourbon. Just a cool 105.4 proof. No big deal.
Not hot at all.
Right on.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks for the invite, guys.
Well, welcome. Do you want me to go first?
You can start first this time.
Right on. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about yourself. Why would people know you? What project that you're working on? You've said that you're a part of the Hemingway, but tell us a little bit about what that is and what people can expect of this project with the Kilkenny's group.
Well, cool. Well, and actually that is a great lead into, we have just now, sorry about that.
I got to remind people.
Yeah, no, I get it. I'm just going to sit here just like this.
Yeah, I know.
We have just now named our company. So now we have formed a hospitality group called Watershed Hospitality.
Oh, cool.
That is encompassing now Kilkenny's, NOLA's, any future projects that we have, and we do have some future projects working in the Hemingway. And so those are our restaurants currently.
Right on.
That's really
cool. How long have you been with Watershed?
Oh, shoot. So I came aboard, that would have been January of 2020. I've been cooking in Tulsa for a long time. John, I don't know if you know this, if you look at Facebook, but I only do it for the memories.
Right.
And today was our 5-year anniversary, six years ago.
Hey,
so we've known each other for the better part of a decade.
We'll hug it out later.
Yeah.
So we've had, you know, another chef, and then we had Elliot Nelson on last episode, and he's obviously opened up restaurants from the ownership business side of things. I'm curious, from a chef's side of things, what doesn't the average consumer or
whoever, citizen or whatever, know that goes into opening a restaurant from a chef's point of view?
You know, in a lot of the restaurants that Elliot opened up, I was with him. So I was, I was an executive chef.
It was fitting to tie that in.
You know, he was a great guy to work with and a great guy to work for. And I had so much fun with that company and got to do a lot of neat stuff. You know, what I would say about opening a restaurant is that it's a very daunting process. And it's also the most fun you can have in this business. It's the only time that when you're doing this, you know, you are cost conscious. I won't say that you're just everything's out the window. But when you get to the point where you are open, there's this 2 week, 3 week period where it's batten down the hatches. Every man, like, you know, you are not worried about labor costs, food costs, the doldrums that actually make a business. You're concentrating on serving people and growing your staff too. So there's this level of teaching and mentorship along with really just figuring it out, like how you're going to run this. Cause I can put this here and it may over the course of a couple of days, just move slightly to the left. And that goes right for everything. And it's also sometimes I can put it here and that's just where that salt lives for the rest of its life. You know, the Dilly Diner, for example, I can go in there right now. I can tell you where their parchment paper is because we set it there when we opened and it hasn't moved. It's on top of the ice bin. You know, it's just there.
What about building a menu?
Building menu is
because do you know that before? Mm-hmm. Not to interrupt you, but I've always wondered the process of, obviously, like if you're going to open a Mexican restaurant, then you kind of have an idea of what that menu is going to look like for the most part. Like you could get crazy and go Oaxaca or go like actual Mexico City style, a little different. Mm-hmm. But when it's a broad canvas that you could paint with, like the Hemingway is, where it's kind of American classic, like steakhouse vibes, do you already have a preset in your mind as a chef of, okay, well then the menu needs to look somewhat like this?
There are two ways to think about that, because you can build a restaurant one of two ways. You can build a restaurant out of a concept that you have, or you can build it out of a menu that you have. Hmm. Both aren't wrong. It just depends. Like you say like let's use, for example, Noma in Copenhagen. That restaurant was pretty much born out of an idea of a menu.
Right.
So, but that's not everybody can do that. That's a very small percentage of restaurants. Most restaurants indeed have to make money. They're not passion projects. And so what you have to do is you have to identify your concept, identify how and who you're wanting to target within that market. And then what you can sell, what boundaries you can push. You have to know how far you can go with it, how far you need to choke up on it. I mean, it's not all about the best thing that you can make. It's about the thing that people will buy. And so you can't.
It's a great distinction too.
Yeah, it's. I would love to say like everything gets the Chevy touch, but that's not really realistic. And be honest with you, that's not what I want to eat every time I go out to eat. Sometimes I just want to eat a cheeseburger or a pizza, but a well-made burger or pizza. And sometimes I like shitty pizza. So you know, like you make what your restaurant can sell. If you write a menu that your restaurant can't sell, then it doesn't matter how good that food is. Mm. If it doesn't match up, that's what we were kind of talking about before here. There are a lot of these inflection points. And if your menu, if you go in and the concepts from the seating to the lighting, to the host, to the service style, if it's contradicting, people may not be able to articulate that, but they'll know it and it won't feel good and you won't go back. You know, it's like a shoe that doesn't fit, a shoe that's too tight, you know, like it could look good, but if it doesn't feel very good, then you're not going to wear it very often.
And that even could be an unconscious decision.
It is. And oftentimes it is. Most of the time when like you're talking about building a menu or building a restaurant, you're talking about a lot of psychology and you're talking about like where, how this restaurant, like even the concept, like, oh, I'd love to do this concept. This place, this building is open. This concept that I have in my head doesn't necessarily fit this area, this building. Like it just depends. It really depends. You can't. A lot of times you'll go into those when we were talking about an uncomfortable restaurant, it's where a restaurant concept was either coddled or loved at some point along the line and then tried to shove into a box that it didn't fit in. And we've all been there. We've all been to the restaurant. I'm like, it's just not quite there.
Yeah.
It's just not like it's.
You can't something. Like, I can't put my finger on it.
Right.
Not being a chef and not being in that industry, but you do.
Oh yeah.
It's like, it's something.
I'm sure it's the same way with breweries and bars. Oh, I mean, we've all been in places where like, it's not matching. Something doesn't.
Lights are too bright or something.
Lights too bright something. Or like they didn't. That like it, this needed to be this or this needed to be that, or like, you know, or you go into a place that's, we'll take a high end example, you know, it's a fancy place, it's beautiful, everything's great, and then you look and see that the legs on the table are just like the cheapest table legs you can buy. And you're like, well, if you're going to go to all this expense and you're going to go to all this trouble and I'm going to walk out of here with a $250 bill, like menus, here's another thing that I like to say too. Menus are promises. A big promise or a small promise. McDonald's menu is a promise. It's promising to feed you. Right. But the more you charge, the bigger promise you're making someone. And so if you don't deliver, like we've all made $300. I mean, everybody in this room has spent $300 on something they shouldn't have.
Absolutely.
I regret that. So when I go into these things, especially a restaurant like the Hemingway, for example, I'm promising you a lot. I'm grateful that you came and took me at my word. But now that's my responsibility to give you that.
Yeah. To deliver.
And exactly to deliver that. So, yeah. So if I charge you what I'm going to charge you for these things.
Right.
Then I'm promising you not just that the food's going to be good. I'm promising you that the service is going to be good. I'm promising you that the wine's going to line up. I'm promising you that light's not going to be blinding you. I'm promising that the bathrooms will be clean. I'm promising you that it will smell good. I'm promising you that you'll feel good.
Right.
And so that's.
And that even goes down to like I've sometimes not gone back to a restaurant for the smallest thing of, and this sounds really petty, but unconsciously probably didn't go back to the restaurant because my water glass didn't get filled. And
you have a choice.
And you have a choice because
whether I can go there, because sometimes you're like, man, that's some real shitty service, but I really like those people, so I'm going to go back.
Right.
Or they don't fill up the water, but man, that tikka masala is real good. You know, it's, but then there's sometimes when you're like, I needed that to be better. I went out on a limb. And it doesn't have to be an expensive thing. You know, it could be just anything. Like you want people here, the clientele today in this hour that we are living in is more informed, more well-traveled, more knowledgeable about food and beverage than it has ever been in the history of the world because of the access to the internet. It's just everybody is in food TV has changed everything. It's changed the way we conduct business. That being said, you also have to have a very thick skin when you're a chef and when you're writing menus, because especially if you're writing menus within a group, you understand that you don't get to say, here it is, I'll see you tomorrow.
No feedback.
I'm going on break.
Yeah.
No, right. you get picked apart and it gets picked apart. And when you're making something, it doesn't always come out of the gate the way you thought it was. And you got to go back to the drawing board. But I mean, seriously, it's just like being a sports player. Even Tom Brady throws interceptions.
Yeah. You know, right.
But it's just the way it is.
Before we get into the third of the six pack of questions, what do you want to fire up over there and put in my belly?
I'm so glad you brought that up. So I brought two wines today. And these are both going to be on our list. Our beverage manager, Scott Phillips, is incredible.
What up, DJ Scott?
Oh, he is. He is one of the most talented.
Yep.
Guys I've ever met in his
we'll have to have him on the show.
I would love to watch him on it because he's just you're gonna have to turn these mics up because you got that real cool voice. But these are two wines I've gotten to work with him a lot because his direction that he wanted to go with the wine menu was not in a vacuum. He wanted to pair it with the food more than anything. So he and I this is honestly, I will say this before we get into that this is the most hands-on I've ever been with a restaurant concept, from picking the silverware and this knife to these plates.
You guys can't see this, but this knife is just beautiful.
It's a French Legris.
Legris.
They have several.
And I'm supposed to use this, right?
Yeah.
You're gonna have to look at it.
You're gonna have to. But okay, so here, hand me your glass down there, John. This is a Big Salt.
Yeah, thanks, man.
This is an Oregon table wine, Pinot Gris mostly. But it's beautiful and it goes really well.
Good taste.
You trying to get me drunk
over there, big boy?
Come on. This ain't a taste.
This is a tasting room.
I know.
Where am I going to take this? I can't be driving around with that. But yeah, so when you taste that guy, and then we'll dive into that seafood. So
yes, we will. And as you're grabbing that, I'm going to ask one more follow up to kind of in the same world of the question I asked earlier, and then I'll let you ask your second one
right there.
But if you were to make a menu, like you said, you make a menu based on things you think will sell, obviously, because you're trying to make money. How much different would the menu look? And take any menu. We'll take Hemingway. How much different would that menu look if you made it based on what you like to eat?
This is where that intersection is so cool.
Yeah.
Because this menu is exactly the way I want it to be.
That's perfect.
In that moment in time, like where we've got this place. And not to say that they won't evolve and it won't change, because I do want to have, you know, that ability to call those audible. So nothing is sacrosanct. But right now, like we've had a lot of time you know, this restaurant was supposed to be open last January, you know, like it's this, we've worked on it, we've tasted it, and I'm happy with it. And so like, given the price point, given the places, given where we're at, I don't know if I would make it any different. I don't know. Like, I don't have any FOMO on this menu. Like, man, I really wish I could serve X because I'm serving exactly what I want in the moment that this place is, because it's going to be beautiful. Yeah. It's nice. So,
oh, that's so fun.
Put some of that on this little plate for me over there.
Yeah, give him some.
What did you bring?
So these are little neck clams, king crab. And I took some out of the shell there too, just in case you didn't want to get messy. And then
sure.
And then just a little cocktail sauce. So
a couple shrimp.
And we're good.
Mm.
Perfect.
There's really none better.
You're welcome.
Mm.
Yeah, you're setting the bar pretty high.
Very high.
Take note, nerds. Don't come up in here empty handed. That goes for you, Colin.
Hey, he brought his sugar milk, and it was delicious.
You know what, man? I will say this. Colin is doing some really cool stuff over there, and I'm really proud of that guy.
Yeah.
Like, I think that from what they're doing and how they're doing it, I think that it's a really neat concept.
One thing you have to be careful of, which I just thought about, this is like a smacking challenge. You can't smack into the microphone.
You gotta sit away.
Right.
Mm. Bring in all of your inner Brad Pitt to the podcast.
Make sure you get some of this king crab. I've shelled some out, but here's the big dad pieces. Here, Johnny, you're just gonna get a dad piece there.
I'm gonna get a dad piece.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and then Austin, you don't even have to put on your plate. I've already cut it open for you, so you don't have to worry about that.
Oh, you did.
Okay. I did. I was just looking
at it like, how am I gonna attack this thing?
No, you're gonna get that. Yeah, see, there you go. That's a big piece.
Look at that. That is gorgeous.
But make sure.
Oh my word.
Dude, that's the money shot right there. How did you
got it?
Well done. Oh, mine's just falling all over the place.
So, yeah, this is going to be part of our menu that you can get. You know, we're going to call it actually on the menu. We're going to have two towers. We'll have a varsity league tower, and then I'm called it the JV tower, which is probably going to be around this size.
That's where John lives, in the JV tower.
In the JV? Nah, man.
Oh, my word. Where did you get these?
These are Bodine's, man. This is, you know, we are very fortunate to have a seafood market that carries really good stuff all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Man, I am loving this podcast right now. You have your next question ready, or are you just...
No, I'm living in this king crab right now.
Stay in the moment.
Oh, but man.
Make sure you try the wine with it, because this wine, again, this was like, this is going to be one of our by the glass selections too, and it's perfect with this. It's perfect. And that's what Scotty did, and I was so happy to get to help with him, was that we got to try. It was like, when we make a suggestion, when, like, you know, you sit down at the table, for example, and the server, that's part of that promise that we talked about. Our promise within that price range is also that our servers are going to be knowledgeable, and they're going to want to give you the experience that they would want to have and that I want to curate for you. So when they come in and they say, you know, you're getting a seafood tower, how about we do a bottle of it? Like, it's because if you're going to do another bottle with the second course, I suggest this one because it's going to be completely reasonable, and there's not going to be a whole lot better out there for this. Of course you can break the bank, but our wine list is, it's going to be really, really neat. I'm really proud of it because of where it lies. It's not just the most expensive cabs and Chardonnays and those things. Like, it's a little left to center. We have, you know, the namesakes that people have to have, but we also have some stuff that we have really thought about and really took time curating for certain dishes, like this one per se, because we've been doing tastings at my house because I got a big kitchen island, and it was easier to control it. But when we tasted and we tasted through and we had this, we were like, that's it. That's the wine for this dish. That's the wine for these towers. Like, it's, and it doesn't have to be a $100 bottle of wine.
No, that's actually one thing that I've noticed about wine is, you know, some of my favorite ones have been in between $15 and $30.
Well, that's absolutely right. There's no reason you have to spend a bajillion dollars, but you can. And that's still good because I've had some that is great at certain, at a smaller price point. And I've had some that didn't wow me at 100, or more, but I'm pleased with this.
Yeah. Okay. So
you ready?
Second question.
Do it.
Yeah. I was thinking of what I wanted to, you know, ask. And one of the things from, you know, you've been in so many different concepts and so many different kitchens, and I was trying to relate myself to you, and I've only done two concepts, basically. Does fatigue ever set in, and how do you push through that as a chef that's always writing new recipes. Because I know for me, I'm only 4 years in and I've hit a, not, I have hit a wall. I've gone through it of recipe development and fatigue.
It's a good question.
It is a great question. You do. I mean, everybody, work is work. That's why they call it work.
Right.
I'm lucky. And I know that you're lucky enough to be doing something that you absolutely love. And that then you can have an interest threshold in too. So I'm not just interested on what I can make. Like I'm actually more interested on what everybody else is doing and seeing. And that's really where I get the most inspiration is looking and traveling and seeing and eating, you know, that's the best part about, you know, that's one of the things that I love about living in Tulsa is that I can get to the airport in 7 minutes from damn near anywhere I'm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I can be anywhere I want pretty quick. Mm-hmm. And I can eat and see things and I can get on. I have some tried and true websites that I go on. Like when I've got a dossier on most cities in my head on like, one of my favorite things is when people ask me, hey, I'm going to, I'll be in San Antonio this week. Where should I? I'm like, give me 2 seconds. And then I can give them about a 7 to 10 restaurant. Like this is for this, this is for this. This is what I would do if I was 36 hours in that city.
Oh man, and, that's awesome.
But that's where you get it. So you go and you see these things that other people are doing and you read books and you give time for yourself too. So that's the biggest thing for me is that I learned early on that the old model of this business, killing yourself, working 80 hours a week is not a badge of honor. It's a sad trope that we were walking, you know, like we can't do that. You can't ask anybody to be creative doing that. You can't ask anybody to give their best work when they're doing that. You can't ask anybody to be in a good mood when they're doing that. And that's what we were trying to promote at the restaurant. You know, we took this time for Watershed to make sure that everybody in our company is either at $15 an hour or busting through that ceiling. That's, you know, that's one thing. And we are very cautious with our managers and our overtime. Like we don't, I refuse to let any of my people work over 50 hours a week. I'm like, first of all, I think that's too many.
Right.
That's not where I want you to be. Mm-hmm. I want you to be.
That's not a fun zone to live.
No, it's not. It's awful. And then people trying to say, I worked 80 hours a week.
But people feel like it's a badge of honor and feel like it needs to happen. And it's funny you brought that up. Like this morning, there was a video on Instagram that I saw, and it was this guy. He was on a radio show, and he was saying it was the biggest lie he's ever been told that, you know, if you work hard, the harder you work, the more money you make. And that's not accurate. It's you have to make your money work for you, right? And it's you have to, because all you'll do if you just, you know, he said, like, how many people did we know growing up that worked 2 jobs? Some worked 3. Did they ever have any more money than the person that worked 1 job? And usually not, right? Usually they're just busting their ass and they're trying so hard and they're just running themselves down. Like it doesn't equate, but in our mind and society, and I'm not trying to get too deep.
You're absolutely right. And this is the precipice that we're on. And this is where we need to talk about this.
Right.
Because
right.
the restaurant industry is one of the worst at how much can we squeeze out of a human being pay them as little as we possibly can. And you know what? I don't care. Like, oh, your mom, I don't care. Where's my steak? I don't care. Why are you not open? You know, like there is a place in Oklahoma City that I like to go to a lot, and I'll name names. I love them. It's called the Powerhouse. It's this little restaurant bar, but the owner there is dedicated to his people. And occasionally, you know what? As a customer, it was kind of annoying because I'd show up and be like, hey, staff needed a break. We're closed today. and you know, I wanted to get a beer after work that day, but you know what? I also said they're people and they deserve to make that decision. Granted, that doesn't work for everybody's business model, but you get it. The theory that I'm talking about is like, We're human beings and we need to treat each other as human beings. And that's, you know, unfortunately getting lost in a lot of the stuff these days. But that whole notion of the chef that grinds and I mean, if anything, the Anthony Bourdain spotlight told us that's not a good model.
Right. Right.
I mean, you're
right. Rest in peace.
No doubt. It's
you, as a human being, I kind of went through a little bit of that at the brewery during COVID. It got down to 2 brewers, myself and my head brewer now. And we were working, 90-hour weeks because it was just us two. And by the end of it, by like a month and a half went by where we were putting in those 90 hours together and it got to a point where we both were like, we can't do this.
And you can't expect others to do it, right?
And we can't expect others to do it. Now, luckily, he is a gracious man and a really hard worker and really dedicated to what we're wanting to do. But it is not sustainable
at all. And it's not if you want to have a career. I mean, no, that's, you know, my first restaurant that I was.
That's a great distinction. Job versus career.
Yeah.
Because you can't do that.
Your body gives out before your heart in this industry. Right. And for me, I knew that. I mean, I have two little girls, and that was always my thing. I remember I was working two jobs at one point, and I saw Trey Winkle was actually at my house. And Nico,
shout out Chef Winkle.
Yeah, shout out Chef Winkle and Nico. They were dating at the time, Nico Albert. So it was like a chef triumvirate at my house.
Was,
yeah. And my daughter Sophia took her first steps. And at that point, I had the only days off that I had was Saturday morning and Sunday afternoon. And because I was working two jobs, and I was like, this isn't the way.
Right.
And you know, that was even before we were able to articulate it as a society. There was still like a lot of old guard. What I think is really exciting right now in our community is that we have that old guard has caught the bus, bro. We are now like collectively the chefs in this town are some of the most. I'm more excited today than I have been ever in this town for the people that are in there and the people that we get to work with and around. Like the community's cool.
Yeah.
Like it's cool. And we all are looking at it and we're all very focused on the people that we are working with and not just the people that we were serving, because those people are important even more so to be able to serve everyone that we want to serve in the way that we want to serve them. It starts with the dude next to me.
Right.
And that's not always the sous chef. I've gotten so lucky, and I'm going off on a little tangent now, maybe it's a whiskey, but I've gotten so lucky.
It's probably
that
whiskey.
I've been doing this a long time, and there's nothing cooler than when somebody comes up that you may have forgotten or haven't thought about in a long time, and they're like, hey, and this just happened recently at DeLisandro's. Kid came in, and I was there just visiting Buzz, and he was like, hey, you remember me? I worked a summer here. You taught me how to cook, and now I have a wife. And I was like, that's a gross, gross over-exaggeration of what you got out of it, but that was really fun that you said that. He was very kind, and he was just, and I had forgotten I had met this kid. To be perfectly honest, I spent a summer with him, but you don't know who you touch.
Right.
And you don't know who in this industry is. That's the coolest part about it. In hospitality and service, and you don't know what difference you make on a day-to-day basis.
Mm.
And it's really fun.
If you want to pick out a beer, I'll go on to the next question that was, and then we'll have you tell us what we're drinking.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll take a beer break. But about, it was kind of what you were just alluding to, Tack, when you said that you haven't been more excited or more proud, you know, than you are right now about the quality of food and maybe the quantity and the different type of things. But so like to even take it further, right? Okay. Like when I have foodie friends, like when we talk about, hey, let's go take a trip to eat somewhere. We're usually talking Charleston or Chicago or Nashville or New York or, you know, LA, San Francisco. What does Tulsa have to do to get in that conversation? And maybe it's not fair because those cities minus Charleston are a lot bigger than Tulsa, but to be on that road, are we there? Are we on that road?
We are on the path.
Okay.
To be perfectly honest with you, we are on the path. I have made no qualms about or reservations about saying I'm gunning for a James Beard with this restaurant. Like, We've had some people nominated in Oklahoma last year. They reconfigured. They moved Texas in its own category, which was always like it was unfair to be lumped in with Texas, Arizona. I mean, which we had.
Yeah.
The James Beard, quite frankly, is a little bit of a it's not the end all be all. However, it's still cool.
Why not shoot for a Michelin star?
Yeah.
Just shoot for a Michelin star.
It's not a Michelin city. Michelin can't travel to every city.
I know.
But that would be fun. But what to your point, where we need to go, and what we need to do. Is be more fearless. The thing that happens in a market such as Tulsa, this many people, is that you have been told your entire career that it's not big enough to alienate a certain clientele.
Yeah.
And I say that there is some truth to that, but I also call bullshit on it too. You can do things like look at Oklahoma City. Oklahoma City's getting there. And that's what makes me mad. It's like you've got these restaurants like Gray Sweater and Nonesuch doing these things. Granted, they're backed by like buy cool like waffle that money or like you know waffle that but like waffle champion money. I mean they have
which is a great place
which is a great place champion. But when you have those kind of things you can go out on a limb and we do have places that we could support that kind of stuff and we do have clientele that we can go after. My restaurant only has 65 seats in it, but I'm going after a certain amount of a clientele base that not necessarily it's not money that I'm going after. It's the people that want to dine, the people that want to go in there and feel something different. This is going to be a sexy place. Yeah. It's going to be a different place than what we're used to here. So
yeah, and the mindset of no, you're good.
Well, is it restaurateurs or is it chefs that need to grow a pair? Like who needs to take that risk? Where
we as restaurateurs need to grow a pair.
Okay,
we do. We in Tulsa, we need to say that it's okay to take a little bit of a risk and to maybe get a little bit ornery, or you know, like we don't have to. I don't have to please every, and this is no disrespect to Broken Arrow. I don't have to please everybody in Broken Arrow, Jinx, Tulsa. Like I don't have, it doesn't have to be for everybody. Cause if you create that clientele that is a repeat clientele, mm-hmm. you don't have to cast the broadest net. And I think that's what we've done for so long is that we're like, okay, but what if we do it like this, if we say this, if we serve it like that, or we call it this, it's going to piss that group off or piss this.
I've heard that multiple times.
Yeah. And I don't think that that's necessarily the case. I think we're into this point of individualism that is now people are taking ownership of their decisions as far as it goes to go out. And there is a certain nature where people are worried in this industry that, oh, if we call it a certain, or like, what are they going to think if we do it like that? Like, I wish that people would stay true to their gut. Oftentimes, I think that a concept here in this town has been watered down before, and I know I've done it. Mm-hmm. I know I've done it, and I've been.
You speak from experience.
Yeah,
then.
I've been guilty of saying, "I wish I could do that," and I don't want to do that anymore. And that's why this restaurant is when it goes back to the first part of that question is like I'm not leaving anything on the table on this one, and I'm excited about that for the first time in a long time. I'm like. When I was a kid,
I've known you for a while. I can feel there's an excitement difference.
When I Your energy's big. When I opened up the first restaurant that I opened up, it's the only restaurant that I've opened. I've got to be a part of over 10 restaurant openings. The only restaurant that I've opened that is now closed was the first one that I opened. It was called Soche downtown.
Soche.
But I was too stupid and naive and young to know. That was pre-Instagram. There was nothing but. We didn't care and we made food that was so exciting. And I remember looking at like some of the old menus and being like, damn, I'd serve that today.
Yeah.
And I remember looking out into the restaurant and we weren't ever that busy because obviously it closed, but but there would be like 7-8 different restaurants represented in GMs or cooks or owners. And like one night I do remember a time where there was Buzz Delisandro was in there and he was like, everybody in here is from a restaurant. He goes, I'm going to do something I've never done before. I'm going to buy around for the house. Cause again, we weren't that busy. Mm. So it wasn't that much, but he did that. And it was, you know, like Matt Sanders and it would be
shout out Vintage Wine Bar.
Vintage Wine Bar. Matt Sanders would be in there. Noah would be in there. Buzz would be in there. We'd have people from every restaurant because it was like this best little, like, culinary kept secret.
Well, and actually, I have a question about Soche later. So tell us what we're drinking. And do you want to do the butter and the stuff for the steak while Austin's describing what we're drinking
let's
here?
Describe this.
Yeah. So cheers, everyone. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So today,
cheers, boy.
I brought.
Tacky.
Salud.
Cheers.
This is this can, if you're watching, is one of the cans that we stick just about anything into it. So this is our solo can it doesn't even have a sticker of what it is.
No, I love it. It's literally just the design.
So if you ever see this can in the tap room, you know that it's going to be unique it's going to be only tap room available and whatnot. So it's really fun. But the reason that it's in this can and this we're drinking Kilkenny's Irish Red today, one, which is really appropriate. Because we are bringing in Trevor Tack, who now how involved are you with the Kilkenny's restaurant?
You know what, Kilkenny's has been around.
Do they need Trevor Tack?
No, they don't, man. To be perfectly honest, I help when it's required.
Yeah,
I don't like to.
If it ain't broke,
don't fix it. You know, like I love Ernesto, the kitchen manager there, and then Eric, the GM. Like we work really, really well together. you know, on special projects, like we'll talk about St. Patrick's Day and those kind of things, but they're day to day, man. They got it down.
Right.
You know, like if they need help with something, they'll ask, but most often they don't. And so they, that, so I'm like, you know what? If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
It's driven around the block a few times.
Yeah. You know, people love it. And why would I be, who am I?
Yeah.
Who am I to mess it up?
This isn't a question, but I just have a comment and I want a chef to come back at me because it's my, I don't know if I'm correct in that I feel this way, but if I go, and this isn't a knock on Kilkenny's because they actually have really good food.
Oh, yeah.
But if I go to a place, we'll just say like Cheesecake Factory.
Okay.
And I see a menu that's 82 pages long that has Mexican, like Italian, American. Right. And Kilkenny's
falls. Sometimes it's a little intimidating.
Well, but not only that, but to me it's like you're either like do one thing well or do a bunch of things mediocre.
Sure.
Right? Like if you don't have a lane...
It's pretty impressive that Kilkenny pulls off that.
But am I
would say 90% of what is on the menu is really good. Excellent.
Yeah, but so Tack, obviously I'm wrong in feeling that way because Kilkenny pulls it off.
You're not necessarily wrong. No, I don't disagree with you. Like I that was one of the things that Brett and I, the Brett's the owner, Brett Rehorn, have always discussed. Like, you know that this menu ain't gonna be as big as you want it to be. For one, I don't have a walk-in. Number two, you know it ain't gonna be that big, right? You know? So there is, he knows that Kilkenny's was birthed and it was grown before we were even here. You know, I mean, like as far as it goes, and you know, like that thing's been around for a long time. He kept adding to the menu, A, because they got good enough to do it and that they could do it well. And B, he's a consummate host. He wants you to be able to say, where can we go? Like, I really want the cottage pie from Kilkenny's. Like, I can find something, you know, and that's what's kept that.
I'll eat a box to you. I'll eat something.
It's a beautiful example of a neighborhood.
Talk dirty to me.
It's not something that I wouldn't, you know, we've recently went through a shoring up of the menu at Nola's. Cause that was another thing.
Yeah. It's another book.
Well, Brett, but it's smaller now. If you haven't been back,
I haven't been in a minute.
We've shored it up. And that was kind of the thing that we had to learn. And that's as a company. And that's what you do though. You learn and you move and you go forward.
I think I know the catalyst of having to shorten that menu. Yeah. So when Gary Busey was in town, we're working on a cartoon with him and it's called Busey's Nuts because he is.
And he's nuts.
He wanted oysters and it was Monday night. And so we were like, well, shit, most places are closed. Like, let's go to Nola's. It might have been Tuesday, Monday or Tuesday, whatever. And so we sit down in a booth. There was six or eight of us. Teresa Knox, who owns Church Studio, owns the building that we're in here at Grass Fire. And,
correct.
You know, owns this whole block, basically. Gary and then a couple of my partners. And when Gary was ready to order, Gary stood up in a relatively busy restaurant, took that book of a menu and threw it across the restaurant. And didn't say anything.
I didn't hear this story, but that's awesome.
And it just like it hits the floor like a ton of bricks.
Yeah.
And
it weighs a lot if you've never been to
Nola's. And he just kind of looks around and then sits down. And I was like, Gary, what the fuck was that?
Yeah.
Like, I probably shouldn't have done that, but I'm ready to order.
Like, shit, dude. Like,
so now
you could have said that.
Brett heard that story, and now it's like a one-page menu. And
it definitely isn't a one-page menu because that's another place that you can go in and have a good time. You know, restaurants shouldn't sell what they can't sell.
Right.
Do that make sense? Correct. I mean, seems silly, but we sell everything in that damn menu.
Yeah.
And people, and that was the other thing. And I'd love to give a shout out to the people of Tulsa when freaking COVID hit, we were scared. And that was like actually my first big job at Watershed Hospitality. What became Watershed was to do the newscast on St. Patrick's Day when they shut us down. And so it was like, Channel 6 is here. Trevor, can you give another interview?
Throw them into
Channel
the
8's here. Can you give another interview? I'm like, yep. I've done quite a bit of TV interviews and you know that
we've done a few things.
But that was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in this industry because A, we didn't know, and then they were asking questions like, so you're getting shut down, how do you feel? And I'm like, well, all my friends are getting fucking fired tonight. Yeah. So what do you think we feel like? And then we pivoted and then we did what restaurant people do and we turned it in and we said, if we can just make X a day. Then we'll be fine. Yeah. And we made so much more than X. We made X, Y, and Z. And, you know, by no means was it a killing, but it was also, it gave us the ability to retain our staff, to be able to come out on the other side and to open a restaurant where this was something that we didn't know if we were going to get to do at the end of the
day. I was never more proud of the restaurant industry than, like, I'll shout out a mutual friend of ours, Josh Royal, and what he did at Roosevelt's with the market. Mm-hmm. I was able to buy things through Roosevelt's that you couldn't find at the store. Toilet paper, paper towels, yep. gloves.
We did
like when you thought you needed gloves.
I didn't know that was
yeah.
going on.
Yeah, he turned it into a market.
I lived in a box.
We did the same
and
thing.
And you did the same thing.
It right in the prohibition room. Yeah. Like, but we all did that. You know, yeah. like a lot, not we all, but a lot of
it was the ingenuity of
and it was, what do we have and what can we sell? Yeah. We had, you know, that was one of the big things at that time was that you have to order oysters in a certain fashion. You can't like order an oyster, you know. So right. we ended up, they sent us right after that. We had 7 cases of Gulf oysters. That's a lot. That's
for no people yeah, coming in.
That's
eat.
A lot. That's a lot. I mean, yeah, like that in one of the biggest sins in this world is letting a living thing die for no reason. You know,
right,
like
right,
I think that waste is hands down one of the ugliest things that we have to contend with in this business. But we put a Facebook post up and said, pennies on the dollar, $50 case of oysters, and we sold out in 20 minutes.
That's awesome.
People were just like, you know what? Judy, yeah. you want some oysters? Tom, let's come on, let's neighborhood oyster yeah. party. And they did it, and it was cool.
Yeah.
And that was cool. And I was proud of
that's
us.
That's awesome.
That's so
like
cool.
us.
Do yeah, you want to cut us up
one,
and we'll do some wine?
Let's talk about this.
And then you have your last question coming too.
Yeah, so. I have my last question. I am going to say something about Kilkenny's Irish
yeah,
Red.
Yeah, do it. It's been delicious.
It's been
one of our biggest sellers.
Really?
Hands
it is.
Down. Yeah. Hands down.
That and so we make Nola's French Ale for Nola's.
Again, our highest selling beer at Nola's is our French Ale.
Yep. And but at one point, it was the number one selling thing on the menu.
I'm going to brag on you too because the White Lion Brown Ale is the best selling beer at White Lion. So it seems like whenever you make a beer for a restaurant, said beer becomes best selling beer.
Yeah.
At the restaurant.
That's a perfect segue for
it. Is what do you have coming?
We do have something coming, which is really cool. I'm going to hold off on that.
Oh, ooh. The tease.
We're not ready.
We're not ready, you slut. You dirty, dirty thing, you. Well, then you want me to talk about my wine?
Sure.
Or
I'm going to say at least one thing about the Kilkenny's. Just getting too excited about everything.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful beer that is the Irish red style was made for the working people.
Give me the history of this one. You know all
Dublin.
The history.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. yeah. So this the
I mean,
Irish
it's not
red,
too hoppy.
No.
But it's not too malty.
And technically, we made this Irish red for Tulsa. And so it's a little bit higher ABV than an actual
what
tradition.
Because we can drink here.
I think it's 4.8, if my memory serves me correct.
Wussies.
Yeah, and so an Irish red in Dublin is actually going to be somewhere in between sometimes 2.8 to 3.4%.
Because you can't trust those guys with that much.
But they drink with that much alcohol,
they couple it with the yeah. whiskey.
They're going to go down to the.
Oh, I've seen it.
Oh yeah,
they just be fighting all the time there.
All the time there.
That
is
the year
one
of Lord 1333.
That is one of the hardest accents you're doing. Pretty good.
It is pretty good. Yeah.
Oh, don't you know there?
Tree. That's the only thing that I can say.
But, but is it its own style? Like, is an Irish red, does that, because I know a lot about beer, but I actually don't know this. Is that a, like an IPA, a pale ale, a Saison? Is
it
an
is
Irish
its own
red
style.
Its own style?
Yeah, it is its
how
own
long
style.
Does it in the, like, comparatively to an IPA or say like a Pilsner, how long does it take to brew an Irish red?
Actually, pretty fairly, surprisingly longer for a lower ABV beer because the yeast strain that we use actually puts out a byproduct of fermentation a lot more than other yeast strains, and you have to you've got to control it, and you've got to give it time to re-up so that the byproduct is called diacetyl, and you got to give the yeast enough time to take that back up.
But is that why lagering so hard? Is that
one reason why lagering is so
hard? If you pulled
it,
would it taste the same, but it would be higher ABV?
Say that again.
If you pulled it sooner?
Time is not, so that's an interesting thing about alcohol. Time does not increase the alcohol.
No, but would it be higher ABV if you pulled it sooner and taste the same?
Oh, no. Okay. No. So, yeah, but it goes so well with food because it's a drier beer. It's perfectly balanced. It's not too sweet and not too malty. And it's just really something special to be able to serve it at Kilkenny's.
People love
it. It's so fun.
It's so much fun to serve, and we love it. And that's the other part about this community that I do love so much is the relationships that we have with separate businesses that are local, you know, like where we do get the opportunity to work with you. And, you know, we were talking about something the other day where Austin came to the office and like, how do you think about this? And we're not there yet, but we'll get there.
Yeah, right. We're getting there. I'm going to say it on the air.
Go ahead.
But we are making, I don't even want to say
not
that.
Let's serve the steak.
Yeah, let's serve this.